we're talking about Islam. Two things worthy of just reminding ourselves of. The function of the Kuzari is not a polemic against Islam. It's not a polemic against Christianity. As I've mentioned before, if that were the function, then it's not a fair fight, because Rabbi Yehuda Halevi really only devotes a little bit more than a page to dismissing Islam, and just a short amount more than that dismissing Christianity, and he spends the rest of the book focusing on Judaism. So we have to remember that we're not here to get a comprehensive understanding of the Islamic faith, and to sort of feel confident that we've now been able to dislodge Islam from its place as a legitimate religion. That's not the objective here. The objective here is to take the preachings or the teachings of Christianity and Islam and to build up, to create some level of contrast between what Christianity emphasizes and its basis for its faith, and to use that as a springboard to describe how Torah is based upon something that's much more sturdy and much more foundational. So let's just keep that in mind. We had mentioned before, we had talked about the Akidah, which is the foundational principles of Islam, and one of them is the unity of God. It's interesting that is one of the six foundational principles of Islam. It's as you know, Islam is founded in the 7th century, so it's a much later faith. It's after Judaism and it's after Christianity. And one of the things that Islam sought to rectify was some of what they perceived to be the mistakes and corruptions that were contained both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. So one of the corruptions of the New Testament that Islam sought to rectify was this idea of a trinity. So therefore the emphasis became an extreme emphasis on the unity of God versus the Trinitarian belief of Christianity. One of the things that's very interesting to note is, from a halachic perspective, is a Jew allowed to pray together with a Muslim? Are we praying to the same God or not? You know, it's much easier for us to argue, perhaps, that the God of a Christian is not the same God of the Jews, because their thoughts are on a trinity, either the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, whatever their beliefs are, but it's certainly some kind of multifaceted Godhead, where the Jews always believe Hashem Echad, but do a Muslim and a Jew pray to the same God? It would seem that there's much more basis to argue that a Jew and a Muslim pray to the same God, even if one were to argue that Christianity is a form of idolatry, which is itself is debated among the medievalists, among the Rishonim. Whether Christianity is idolatry or not is a subject of debate. The Rambam clearly states that Christianity is a form of idolatry because of its principle of shituf, that it creates three aspects of God, which is a form of sort of creating different aspects to the Godhead. But he says that Islam is not idolatry. Islam is not a complete compliance with the Noahide laws that every Gentile is called upon to observe, but at the same time, it's not idolatry. This has a number of ramifications in Jewish law. One of them could possibly be is what about Islamic manufactured wine? You know, if a non-Jew manufactures wine, that there's a halacha called stam yeinam, which is wine that's manufactured by a Gentile without the explicit purpose of it being for idolatrous purposes. If its purpose is explicitly for idolatrous use, it's called yayin nesach. It's called idolatrous wine, in which case it's clearly prohibited by the Torah. The rabbis came in and they added another prohibition, and they said there's something called Stam Yenam, which is all wine manufactured by a non-Jew, is prohibited, but it's a specific kind of non-Jew. It's a non-Jew who is idolatrous by nature, so they said that there's a fear that even though it's not explicitly for the purpose of idolatry, it's really for commercial consumption, nevertheless, we're fearful that the Gentile may have had some idolatry in his mind when he manufactured the wine, and as a result, we prohibit all wine manufactured by an idolater. So here's where the Rambam makes a very important distinction in halacha between a Christian manufactured wine and Muslim manufactured wine. Christian manufactured wine is prohibited both for consumption and for what's called hana'ah. You're not allowed to get any benefit from it, which means that if I have a case of Christian manufactured wine, I'm not even allowed to sell it and make money off of it. I can't get any benefit from it whatsoever. Right? The difference there, however, would be is if I have Muslim manufactured wine that was manufactured by a group of Muslims, then I would not be allowed to consume it, but I would be allowed to sell it and make money off of it. That's an important distinction between the two in halacha. So of course your question is, what's a nice Muslim doing manufacturing wine? Because Muslims are not supposed to drink wine. Well, the answer of course is that Muslims have commercial interests just like anyone else does. So even though they can't drink it, they could still manufacture it. So that's why the Rambam addresses this. Now, of course, there are plenty of other Rishonim who disagree with the Rambam. And it's interesting to note, and I allow this is certainly open for speculation as to the reasons why there are differences of opinion in this matter, but I think it's perhaps more than just a coincidence that the Rambam is living in Islamic world, in Egypt, and his counterparts that disagree with him are living in Christian lands in Northern Europe. And they opine that even though Christians may or may not be idolaters, nevertheless, the wine that is manufactured by Christians, while it is prohibited for consumption, one is still allowed to capitalize and use it for commercial trade. And there are a number of reasons that are offered for that, either because the Christians living at the time when this discussion takes place, which is sometime around the 12th and 13th centuries, the Christians of that time are not, although their practices may be idolatrous in nature, they're only imitating earlier generations that were truly idolatrous, and this is only a remnant. Whatever they do today is not truly a form of idolatry. And there are other reasons that are given as well. But it's just an interesting notation. I don't want you to take any halachic conclusions from this. As a general rule, wine that is manufactured by a non-Jew, you're not really supposed to get any benefit from. That's our minhag today. And the Shulchan Aruch says it's appropriate to be machmir even nowadays when there's really no idolatry going on, so to speak. And whether the debate of whether Christianity is idolatry or not is it's a gray area. But the custom is to be machmir, that unless there's a serious loss that one stands to incur by disposing of the Gentile manufactured wine, then one should really not get any benefit from a bottle of wine that is presented to him or her by a Gentile. So this came up in a shir. You can watch it on Kosher too, what we're supposed to do with the Gentile wine. When we get a gift of it from a non-Jew, we won't go into that now. But the simple understanding is that you should not get any benefit from it at all. All right? Okay, so now there could be other ramifications that are quite significant as to whether you know, the differences between Christianity and Islam. One example, one issue could also be, you know, we know that it's quite an accepted tradition that we don't walk into a church. Can you walk into a mosque? So this is another issue that it would seem clear that there's more reason to be lenient to allow someone to walk into a mosque than to allow someone to walk into a church. And yet there are those authorities that are machmir, that do not allow a person to walk into a mosque as well as walking into a church. But one should know that if there are compelling situations, you should discuss it with your rabbi and find out what the halacha would allow you and would not allow you to do. Okay? You know, sometimes for the sake of the Jewish people, it may be necessary at sometimes to walk into a mosque, and that has to be analyzed carefully. Okay. So we're up to Muhammad. One of the things that the Muslim had said on the bottom of page 62 is that no mortal could ever write a book such as ours, nor even a single sentence such as those in our Quran. It's the words themselves, as we mentioned last time, are themselves reflective of the divine nature of the Quran. That's what Muslims profess. That's what they claim. It becomes even more acute when you consider the fact that according to Islamic history, Muhammad was illiterate. He was a complete ignoramus, sort of like, you know, this Saudi Arabian peasant who wanders into a cave and has this amazing revelation, and all of a sudden he becomes extremely articulate and is able to express these divine and very, very esoteric and profound ideas. The only way he could have gotten them is if he had a revelation of some kind, because he just didn't possess sufficient knowledge to be able to write these things down. So that's at least according to Islamic history. Okay, so therefore that leads us to Muhammad. Okay, so we need a reader for today. We're up to the sentence, "We also believe that our prophet Muhammad." Okay, we need a reader, someone close to the camera. Someone want to volunteer? Yes, please.
"We also believe that our prophet Muhammad is the last of the prophets, and that his teaching supersedes all doctrine that preceded him."
One of the big debates within the Islamic world today, I think it's one of the things that divides the Sunnis and the Shia, is as far as what the status of later prophecies after Muhammad have. In other words, what authority those prophecies have. I don't know with great clarity. It's not something that I've studied extensively, but that's certainly one of the issues. The reason why there's a movement within the United States, something like the Black Islam, Black Muslim Brotherhood, I think it's called, you know, the one that Farrakhan is in charge of. The reason why most Muslims in America do not recognize the authority of that, so that they don't think that that's authentic Islam, is because they believe that the Black Brotherhood, the Black Islamic Brotherhood, believes in later prophets after Muhammad. But real authentic Islam says Muhammad is the last and final word on everything, and that there cannot come any other prophets after Muhammad. But at the same time, he supersedes all previous prophecies. Now, that's not to say that all previous prophecies are false. It just means that if you ever find a contradiction between what Muhammad says and between what Musa, which is Moses, or what Yeshu says, then, or Jesus says, then you have to take Muhammad's word as the authentic word. And it's not that they said something incorrect, but it just means that Muhammad was clarifying what they meant, and perhaps rectifying something that had gotten corrupted into an earlier text that had been either corrupted by Jews or Christians. So the Quran is a rectification of all previous texts. They accept all previous prophets, which is why when you walk into, well, it depends if you're going to ever walk into a mosque or not, but if you ever see a picture of the inside of a mosque, you'll notice that all across the front of the mosque, written in Arabic, are the names of all of the prophets, starting with Noah, or Adam, Noah, I don't remember if Adam's on there or not, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Ishmael, and, you know, Moses. I don't remember all the names of all of the prophets that they believe in, but they're all written, and Jesus is up there too, all of them are written across the mosque. And that's why Islam professes to embrace Judaism and Christianity, not to reject it, but we embrace your prophets. Your people are our people, and therefore Islam is the sort of supplementation, not the rejection of Judaism and Christianity, but it makes it whole. It creates it. It makes it complete. It's the completion of Judaism and Christianity. Okay, let's go on.
He calls to all nations to convert to Islam. The reward after death for one who follows Muhammad is the return of the soul to the body, which will dwell in the Garden of Eden. Such a person will lack no delight, food, drink, women, and all that his soul desires. But he who rebels against Islam will descend to a never-ending fire, and his suffering will last forever.
And of course, these are very vivid in the writings of the Quran, and later writings in Islam as well. Very vivid graphic images of the punishment that awaits the sinner. And of course, we know about the 9/11 bombers who wanted to get their 72 maidens, and those poor maidens, if you feel sorry for them, right? But that's in Islam, it's a very somewhat, well, let me just put it this way, it's a very objectified, solidified, concretized image, a physical type of pleasure that awaits someone in the Garden of Eden if they die as a shaheed, or if they die as a martyr, or if they are righteous and they do what they're supposed to do for Islam. Okay, now, what is missing from this account of what we believe? We saw Christianity. We saw Christianity is that there is a certain amount of irrationality or illogic to believe in Christianity, because it requires a belief in a virgin birth. It requires a belief in a God who is above the physical universe to occupy physical form. And so the Khazar king had rejected Christianity based upon the illogic of what Christian doctrine says that someone is supposed to believe in. That was sort of the rejection of Christianity in a nutshell. It doesn't make sense. And if you want to prove something to me that doesn't make sense, I'm prepared to believe things that are irrational. I am prepared. Because sometimes things that seem irrational really become rational once it's proven to me that it's true. The problem with Christianity is that you have no evidence for these things. And if you have no evidence, you have no physical evidence for the virgin birth, and you have no evidence for God occupying human form, so then I can't accept them, because the logic of these things is just, it's just too far for me to process, and I can't accept it. Here in Islam, you know, there's nothing that's so highly illogical. There's no virgin birth, there's no claim that God assumes a physical form. But what do we have here? We have here a claim that God communicated with a peasant in a cave, and was able to provide all of the teachings of what a person, a human being, is supposed to live his life, how they're supposed to live their life, and a guarantee for a reward, and that he was given a book that is divine in its nature, and that if he obeys all of the commandments of Islam, then he has eternal paradise. Okay? Now here again, there's going to be some evidentiary problems, because we don't have evidence for these things. And so this is again going to be Reb Yehuda Halevi's argument. Not so much that it's irrational, but even things that make sense and seem reasonable, you still are going to need to provide me with proof. But it goes more than just provide me with proof. There's something logical about the need for proof. And what we're going to see here in just a moment is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's assertion that if God was going to come and reveal to mankind what his wishes of humanity are, then he would have to in some way demonstrate that it's God who is speaking. You understand? In other words, if you were God and you wanted to introduce yourself to the world, and you wanted to tell the world that you have some beautiful ideas and you have a new set of laws that you would like for them to observe, how would you introduce yourself as God? Would you choose a peasant and put him in a cave and whisper into his ear so that no one could hear, and then say, now go out and teach this to the world? Or would you create a grand spectacle so that the world, or at least a very large segment of humanity, would be witness to this spectacle, so that it would make an impression, so that people would realize, hey, this comes from God. So this is going to be the problem that the king has with Islam. And as I mentioned, what are we setting ourselves up for? We're setting ourselves up for the perfect way for God to reveal himself to the world is by having a revelation that is accompanied by miracles. Because that's exactly the way the Torah says that the Exodus and the subsequent Matan Torah took place. The giving of the Torah and its precursors, which is the Yetzias Mitzrayim and all of its miracles, were done specifically because that's the most logical way that God would want to reveal himself. If he wants to communicate with human beings, this is what I want you to do. He wouldn't whisper it into a single prophet's ear. He would make sure that the world understands it's me, it's God speaking. Okay, so let's take a look. Please continue with paragraph 6 on page 63. Maybe a little louder for us, please. Thanks.
The Khuzari responded, if you want to prove that God exists and that God communicates with humans, and the person whom you are attempting to convince is a non-believer, then you need to begin with an account of famous miracles that are irrefutable. Only then is there a chance that the person will believe that God communicated with man. You claim that the wondrous text of your holy book proves the existence of God, and that this can only be appreciated in the original Arabic. That may be so, but for a foreigner such as myself who does not understand Arabic, this proof is meaningless. You can read the Quran to me all you want, but I cannot tell the difference between one Arabic book and another.
Right, so it almost becomes a circular argument. So the Muslim will tell you, well, the reason you don't appreciate the divine nature of the Quran is because you've never read it in the original Arabic. But if you were to read it in the original Arabic, you'd have a much more profound appreciation for its beauty and its depth, and you would be forced to conclude that it's divine in nature. Well, you know, that's wonderful. What does this do for all the people who don't speak Arabic? And it also begs another question, which is, why would God choose to communicate a universal message there, in that Islam calls upon the entire world to become Islamic, to become Muslims? Why would God choose to communicate that message and embed its proof of its divinity in a language that only one segment of the population is capable of appreciating? If God really wants to prove that it's me, God, who's speaking, yeah? And you, Muhammad, or you, the Muslim, say, well, the proof is right there. You don't appreciate it because you don't speak Arabic. Well, if God is going to try and prove to me that he's God and he's speaking and he's presenting me with the Quran, why would he put it in a language that only 1%, small percentage of the world is capable of understanding? Now, appreciate this. This idea is very relevant to Torah. Because what language did God give the Torah in? The Hebrew. What percentage of the world were Hebrew speakers at this time? A very small percentage. The Jewish people, according to our tradition, preserved their language even while they were slaves in Egypt. So they were capable of accepting the Torah. But why did God choose to give the Torah only in Hebrew if the Torah was meant for all of humanity?
Because he chose them. He chose the people.
Because, yes, he chose the Jews, and he did not choose all of humanity. So this, again, points to the non-universal nature of the Jewish faith. The particular nature of the Jewish faith, the particularist, I should say, nature of the Jewish faith, that whereas Christianity and Islam proclaim that our respective faiths are meant for the entire world to embrace, the Torah, according to Judaism, is not meant for the entire world. It is meant exclusively for the Jewish people. And the very proof that Muslims bring to argue for the divinity of the Quran is the very proof that we use, that Rabbi Yehuda Levi is going to use momentarily, to prove that the Torah was only meant for Klal Yisrael and it was not meant for the rest of the world. Because if truly Hashem meant it for the rest of the world, why would he give it in one specific language that only a segment of the population can understand and appreciate? So we're not negating the possibility that the very specific words of the Quran in their original Arabic may actually convey some kind of divine, origin. That's not the we're not directly arguing against that. Whether they do or not, right? We're ready to dismiss that right now. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But one thing is for sure: if I'm meant to become a Muslim, and the convincing argument is going to be based on the special nature of the words, then it doesn't make sense. Then God would have chosen, if God wanted to convince me to become a Muslim, he would have given me the Quran in a language that was more accessible to the rest of humanity. Maybe he would have given it in 70 languages. Maybe he would have chosen 70 prophets, each one speaking a different language. So Muhammad would have been the prophet for the Arabs, and then he would have chosen a Jewish Muhammad counterpart, and then a Christian who spoke Latin or Greek at the time, right? And then he would have chosen someone else who spoke some other language, and then that would have become an international, universal religion for the whole world to subscribe to. But that's not what happened. Yes? So this is all part and parcel of the argument that the Khazar king is making against the universal nature of Islam. So that's the argument. So the Muslim is put on the defensive at this point, the Qadi, the Islamic judge, and he's got to come up with some kind of response. Let's just begin the response that he's presenting.
The wise Muslim responded, "Our Prophet did perform great miracles. However, knowing the story of these miracles was never deemed necessary for acceptance of our religion."
Right. And the argument, part of that argument, as the Otsar Nechmad points out, one of the commentaries on the Khuzari, is that Islam, especially Islam in the 12th century when this is being written, is a very rational religion. It's a religion that is based upon logic. It is a religion that prides itself on the fact that we can explain all of our religious principles based upon logical, philosophic principles. And therefore, to say that acceptance of our faith hinges upon miracles is, for the Islamic philosophical ear, an insult. It's a deprecation of Islam. To say that the basis for believing what Muslims believe is based upon a revelation, we don't need revelations. There's great logic and logical, rational appeal to Islam, and that's why we've never emphasized the importance of miracles. Now again, what Yehuda HaLevi is doing is foreshadowing a contrast between Islam and Judaism, at least his version of Judaism, which is very much dependent upon miracles, which is very much dependent upon God revealing himself in a very public way and saying, "Hey, it's me." And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's argument is, and as we're going to discuss this extensively as we go along, you can't prove religion based on logic. For Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, there's no such thing as convincing someone purely based on logic that I'm right and they're wrong. And the reason is because the mind is a very peculiar instrument that can a lot of times play tricks on you. And that's why we have some very, very smart people who have not converted to Judaism. I mean, isn't it bizarre that the entire, the very small segment of the population are not Jewish? And if the truths of Judaism are self-evident, would you not expect all of the wise people of the world to have converted to Judaism by now? If it is such a convincing faith, if its truths are so self-evident and logical? Well, for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, the answer is simple. No, that's not what logic, the mind, there's so many other things at play within the human psyche besides a rational thinking argument. And it's therefore not a surprise why the rest of the world has not embraced Judaism. Because logic does not play a role, at least not as much of a role, in accepting Judaism as it does for the Muslim. Okay, and that's really them's fighting words when Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi makes that claim, because there are others that are Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's contemporaries who would very strongly disagree. There are those who would say that we appreciate what the Islamic project is about. The Islamic project in the medieval period is to say, you know, you can be religious and still be rational, and you can say that there's a rational basis for the acceptance of Judaism or the acceptance of Islam, and therefore there's no contradiction. Well, of course, there's a certain appeal to that argument too. And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi emphasizes the fact that you never have to compromise on your rationality in order to be an observant Jew, in order to be a person of profound faith. But it's one thing to say that there's no contradiction between religion and rationality or science or philosophy. But it's another thing to say that you can prove religion through rational logical arguments in philosophy. See those are two very, very different things. It's one thing to say there's no contradiction between religion and logic. That's one thing, and everyone has to believe in that, because Hashem would never ask of us to do that which is illogical. But it's a completely other thing to suggest that I can use logical arguments and proofs to prove Judaism. There was someone who was at, I don't know if she's at the shir today, I don't see her today, someone who wanted to bring a speaker, and with this we'll finish the Kuzari part of our shir today. There was someone who wanted to bring a speaker to the shul, to the bayit, whose whole presentation is to show, using scientific proofs, did I tell you about this last time? Yeah? Using scientific proofs to prove the truths of the Torah and Judaism. And that's what sometimes there are seminars that try to do this, and for those who have an appreciation, it's a very Maimonidean approach, and I have an appreciation for that, but I also have an appreciation for the fact that a really, really smart person will be able to dismantle every single proof that you bring to the truth of Judaism. Let's keep that in mind. I don't think that the Nobel Prize winners who are atheists are stupid, and that's the reason why they're not religious Jews. There are plenty of very, very smart, even Jewish Nobel Prize, especially smart Jewish Nobel Prize winners who are atheists. And the reason why they don't believe in God or they don't subscribe to Judaism is not because they fail to see the proofs. It's because there's no such thing as an ironclad proof to religion. The only thing that's ironclad is revelation. And that's what we're going to get to. Okay, so Ad Kan.